At first he makes little use of it, since he is but very dimly conscious, and very poorly fitted to apprehend facts, and their varied interrelations, but gradually his power to appreciate what he sees increases, and later comes the ability to remember such flashes at the end of previous lives, and to compare them, and so to estimate the progress which he is making along the road which he has to traverse. In addition, he will devote some time to his plans for the life which lies before him. His consciousness gradually increases, until he comes to have an appreciable life on the higher levels of the mental plane, each time that he touches them. The fifth heaven, the third subplane, this is, of course, the lowest of the Arupa or formless mental subplanes. It is also the most populous of all the regions with which we are acquainted, because here are present almost all the 60,000 million souls who are said to be engaged in the present human evolution, all, in fact, except the comparatively small number who are capable of functioning on the second and first subplanes. As we have already seen, each soul is represented by an ovoid form, which at first is a mere colorless film, but which later, as the ego develops, begins to show a shimmering iridescence like a soap bubble, colors playing over its surface like the changing hues made by sunlight on the spray of a waterfall. Those who are connected with a physical body are distinguishable from those in the disembodied state by a difference in types of vibrations set up on the surface of their causal bodies, and it is therefore easy, on this plane, to see at a glance whether an individual is or is not in incarnation at the time. Page 91. The immense majority, whether in or out of the body, are but dreamily semi-conscious, though few are now in the condition of mere colorless films. Those who are fully awake are marked and brilliant exceptions, standing out amid the less radiant crowds like stars of the first magnitude. Between these and the least developed are ranged every variety of size and beauty, each thus representing the exact stage of evolution at which he has arrived. The majority are not yet sufficiently definite, even in such consciousness as they possess, to understand the purpose of the laws of the evolution in which they are engaged. They seek incarnation in obedience to the impulse of the cosmic will, and also to Tanha, the blind thirst for manifested life, the desire to find some region in which they can feel and be conscious of living. In the earlier stages, such entities cannot feel the intensely rapid and piercing vibrations of the highly refined matter of their own plane, the strong and coarse, but comparatively slow, movements of the heavier matter of the physical plane are the only ones that can evoke any response from them. Hence it is only on the physical plane that they feel themselves to be alive at all, and this explains their strong craving for rebirth into earth life. Thus for a time their desire agrees exactly with the law of evolution. They can develop only by means of those impacts from without, to which they are gradually aroused to respond, and in this early stage they can receive them only in earth life. By slow degrees their power of response increases, and is awakened, first to the higher and finer physical vibrations, and still more slowly to those of the astral plane. Next, their astral bodies, which until now have been merely bridges to convey sensations to the ego, gradually become definite vehicles which they can use, and their consciousness begins to be centered rather in their emotions than in the mere physical sensation. At a later stage, but always by the same process of learning to respond to impacts from without, the egos learn to center their consciousness in the mental body, to live in and according to the mental images which they have formed for themselves, and so to govern the emotions with their mind. Yet further along the long road of evolution, the center moves up to the causal body, and the egos realize their true life. When that stage is reached, however, they will be found upon a higher subplane than this, the third, and the lower earthly existence will be no longer necessary for them. But for the present, we are dealing with the less evolved majority, who still put forth, as groping, waving tentacles into the ocean of existence, the personalities which are themselves on the lower planes of life. But they are as yet in no sense aware that these personalities are the means whereby they are to be nourished and to grow. They see nothing of their past or future, not being yet conscious on their own plane. Nevertheless, as they are slowly drawing in experience, and assimilating it, there develops a sense that certain things are good to do, and others bad, and that expresses itself imperfectly in the connected personality as the beginning of a conscience, a feeling of right and wrong. Gradually, as they evolve, the sense more and more clearly formulates itself in the lower nature, and becomes a less inefficient guide to conduct. By means of the opportunities given by the flash of consciousness, to which we have previously referred, the most advanced egos of this subplane develop to a point at which they are engaged in studying their past, tracing out the causes set going in it, and learning much from retrospection, so that the impulses sent downwards become clearer and more definite, and translate themselves, in the lower consciousness, as firm convictions and imperative intuitions. Page 92. It should be unnecessary to point out that the thought images of the other rupa or form levels are not carried into the higher heaven world. All illusion now is past, and each ego knows his real kindred, sees them, and is seen, in his own royal nature, as the true immortal man that passes on from life to life, with all the ties intact that are knit to his real being. On this third subplane are also to be found the causal bodies of the comparatively few members of the animal kingdom who are individualized. Strictly speaking, as we have previously seen, these are not animals any longer. They are practically the only examples now to be seen of the quite primitive causal body, undeveloped in size, and as yet colored only very faintly by the first vibrations of newly born qualities. When the individualized animal retires into his causal body, to await the turn of the wheel of evolution, which shall give him an opportunity of a primitive human incarnation, he seems to lose almost all consciousness of outer things, and to spend the time in a sort of delightful trance of the deepest peace and contentment. Even then, interior development of some sort is surely taking place, though its nature is difficult for us to comprehend. In any event, he is enjoying the highest bliss of which, at his level, he is capable. Page 93, Chapter 20, The Sixth Heaven, Second Subplane. From the densely thronged fifth heaven, we pass now into the more thinly populated world, as out of a great city into a peaceful countryside. For, at the present stage of human evolution, only a small minority of individuals have risen to this loftier level, where even the least advanced is definitely self-conscious, and also conscious of his surroundings. He is able, at least to some extent, to review the past through which he has come, and is aware of the purpose and method of evolution. He knows that he is engaged in a work of self-development, and recognizes the stages of physical and post-mortem life, through which he passes in his lower vehicles. The personality, with which he is connected, is seen by him as part of himself, and endeavors to guide it, using his knowledge of the past as a store of experience from which he formulates principles of conduct, clear and immutable convictions of right and wrong. These he sends down into the lower mind, superintending and directing its activities. In the earlier part of his life on this subplane, he may continually fail to make the lower mind understand logically the foundations of the principles he impresses upon it, yet, nevertheless, he succeeds in making the impression, so that such abstract ideas as truth, justice and honor, become unchallenged, and ruling conceptions in the lower mental life. So firmly are such principles wrought into the very fibers of his being that, no matter what may be strain of circumstance or the torment of temptation, to act against them becomes an impossibility. For these principles are the life of the ego. While, however, he thus succeeds in guiding his lower vehicle, his knowledge of that the vehicle and its doings is often far from precise and clear. He sees the lower planes but dimly, understanding their principles rather than their details, and part of his evolution on this subplane consists in coming more and more consciously into direct touch with the personality, which so imperfectly represents him below. Only such persons as are deliberately aiming at spiritual growth live on this subplane, and they have, in consequence, become largely receptive of influences from the planes above them. The communication grows and enlarges, and a fuller flood pours through. Under this influence, the thought takes on a singularly clear and piercing quality, even in the less developed. The effect shows itself in the lower mind as a tendency to philosophic and abstract thinking. In the more highly evolved, the vision is far-reaching, it ranges with clear insight over the past, recognizing the causes set up, They're working out, and what remains of their effects still unexhausted. Page 94. Egos living on this plane have wide opportunities for growth when freed from the physical body, for here they may receive instruction from more advanced entities, coming into direct touch with their teachers. No longer by thought pictures, but by a flashing luminousness impossible to describe, the very essence of the idea flies like a star from one ego to another, its correlations expressing themselves as light waves pouring out from the central star, and needing no separate enunciation. A thought here is like a light placed in a room, it shows all things round it, but requires no words to describe them. In this, the sixth heaven, a man sees also the vast treasures of the divine mind in creative activity, and can study the archetypes of all the forms that are being gradually evolved in the lower worlds. He may unravel the problems connected with the working out of those archetypes, the partial good that seems as evil to the limited vision of men encased in flesh. In the wider outlook of this level, phenomena assume their due relative proportions, and a man sees the justification of the divine ways, so far as they are concerned with the evolution of the lower worlds. Page 95, Chapter 21. The seventh heaven, first subplane, this most glorious level of the heaven world, has but few denizens as yet from our humanity, for on its heights dwell none but the masters of wisdom and compassion, and their initiated pupils. In one of the earlier letters, received from a master, it was stated that to comprehend the condition of the first and second elemental kingdoms, that is, those on the causal and lower mental planes, was impossible except to an initiate, hence we cannot expect success in attempting to describe them on the physical plane. Of the beauty of form, and color, and sound, on the causal plane, no words can speak, for mortal language has no terms in which those radiant splendors may find expression. In touching the seventh heaven, we come in contact for the first time with a plane which is cosmic in its extent. For this, the atomic part of our mental plane, is the lowest subplane of the mental body of the planetary logos. On this level, therefore, may be met many an entity which mere human language has no words to portray. For our present purposes, however, it will be best to put aside altogether those vast hosts of beings whose range is cosmic, and confine ourselves strictly to the inhabitants peculiar to the mental plane of our chain of worlds. Those who are on this sub-plane have accomplished the mental evolution, so that in them the higher shines out ever through the lower. From their eyes the illusion veil of personality has been lifted, and they know and realize that they are not the lower nature, but use it only as a vehicle of experience. In the less evolved of them, it may yet have power to shackle and to hamper, but they can never fall into the blunder of confusing the vehicle with the self behind it. From this they are saved, because they carry their consciousness not only from day to day, but from one incarnation to another, so that past lives are not so much looked back upon, as always present in the consciousness, the man feeling them as one life, rather than as many lives. On this subplane, the ego is conscious of the lower heaven world, as well as of his own. If he has there any manifestations, as a thought form, in the heaven life of his friends, he can make the fullest use of them. On the third sub-plane, and even in the lower part of the second, his consciousness of the sub-planes below him was still dim, and his action in the thought form largely instinctive and automatic. But as soon as he got well into the second sub-plane, his vision rapidly became clearer, and he recognized their, page 96, thought forms, with pleasure, as vehicles through which he was able to express more of himself, in certain ways, than he could do through his personality. Now that he is functioning in the causal body, amidst the magnificent light and splendor of the highest heaven, his consciousness is instantaneously and perfectly active at any point in the lower divisions to which he wills to direct it, and he can, therefore, intentionally project additional energy into such a thought form, when he wishes to use it for the purpose of teaching. From this highest level of the mental plane come down most of the influences, poured out by the masters of wisdom, as they work for the evolution of the human race, acting directly on the souls, or egos, of men, shedding upon them the inspiring energies which stimulate spiritual growth, which enlighten the intellect, and purify the emotions. From here genius receives its illumination, here all upward efforts find their guidance. As the sun rays fall everywhere from one center, and each body that receives them uses them after its nature, so from the elder brothers of the race fall on all men the light and life which it is their function to dispense. Each uses as much as he can assimilate, and thereby grows and evolves. Thus as everywhere else, the highest glory of the heaven world is found in a glory of service, and they who have accomplished the mental evolution are the fountains, from which flows strength for those who are still climbing. On the three higher levels of the mental plane are to be found the hosts of Arupa or formless devas, who possess no body denser than the causal. The nature of their life appears to be so essentially different from the life we lead as to make it impossible to describe in physical words. Arupa devas are connected with the guidance of the worlds, of races, of nations. There is also a very limited class of men, conscious on the Arupa levels of the mental plane, who have been sorcerers in the past. In them the higher intellect is awakened, and with it the intellectual recognition of unity. They now perceive that they have been on the wrong path, that it is not possible to hold back the world, and prevent it from climbing on the upward arc. Being still tied by the karma they have made, they have to work on the wrong side, that is, on the side of disintegration. But they work with a changed motive, and endeavor to turn their forces against those men who are in need of being strengthened by having to struggle against resistance in their spiritual life. This truth appears to have been perceived by Marie Corelli, who dealt with the point in her book The Sorrows of Satan. The Satan there described is always glad when he is defeated. He exerts himself to oppose, but rejoices when a man proves himself spiritual enough to resist. This side of life is recognized also in the Hindu Puranas. There are cases in which a man has evolved to a very high point of knowledge, and then incarnates to expiate some of his past karma, in the form of an opponent of good, like Ravana. By his past karma he is compelled to gather up in himself the evil forces of the world, in order that they may be destroyed. Other religions have the same idea in different forms. Page 97, Chapter 22, Krishna, the cause of reincarnation. We have now practically completed our study of the nature, functions, growth and development of the causal body. Having thus studied what we may call the form side of the ego, it is now necessary that we endeavor to obtain some further understanding of the ego himself, as a conscious, functioning entity. In the present chapter we shall commence the study of the ego in his relation to his personalities. This practically amounts to the life side of reincarnation. The first part of our subject will be Krishna, that first which is the primary reason why the ego seeks reincarnation. In the next chapter we will deal more specifically with the form side of reincarnation, that is, its mechanism. Then we shall deal with other aspects of the attitude of the ego towards the personality. After that, we shall pass to a study of the life of the ego on his own plane. Finally, we must study, so far as our materials permit, the relation of the ego to the monad. The primary and essential reason for reincarnation is the cosmic will, which impresses itself upon the ego, appearing in him as a desire for manifestation. In obedience to this, the ego copies the action of the Logos by pouring himself forth into the lower planes. More specifically, this desire is known in Sanskrit as Trishna, or thirst in Pali as Dan. It is the blind thirst for manifested life, the desire to find some region where the ego can, 1. Express himself, and, 2. Receive those impressions and impacts from without which alone enable him to be conscious of living, to feel himself alive. This is not desire for life in the ordinary sense of the word, but rather for a more perfect manifestation, a desire to feel himself more thoroughly alive and active, a desire for that complete consciousness which involves the power to respond to all possible vibrations from the surroundings, on every plane, so that the ego may attain the perfection of sympathy, that is, of feeling with. As we shall see more fully later on, the ego on his own plane is far from being fully conscious. But what consciousness he has gives him a feeling of great pleasure, and arouses a kind of hunger for a fuller realization of life. It is this hunger of the ego, in fact, which lies behind the world's great clamor for a fuller life. It is not an outside pressure which drives a man back into incarnation. He comes because he wants to come. If the ego did not want to come back, he would not return, but so long as any desire remains for anything that the world can give him, he will want to come back. Thus an ego is not driven, against his will, back to this world of troubles, but his own intense hunger for it brings him back. Page 98. We may take an analogy from the physical body. When food has been taken, and completely assimilated, the body wants more food, becomes hungry. No one has to drive the man to eat, he gets food and eats it, because he wants it. Similarly, so long as man is imperfect, so long as he has not assimilated everything this world can give, and utilized it to the full, so that he does not want anything more from this world, so long he will return to rebirth. Trishna may be conceived as one of the many ways in which the universal law of periodicity manifests itself. In the esoteric philosophy, this law is recognized as extending to the emanation and reabsorption of the universe. The night and day of Brahma, the outbreathing and the inbreathing of the great breath. Hence Hindus have pictured the god of desire as the impulse to manifestation. Karma is in the Rig Veda, X.129, the personification of that feeling, which leads and propels to creation. He was the first movement that stirred the One, after its manifestation from the purely abstract principle, to create. Desire first arose in it, which was the primal germ of mind, and which sages, searching with their intellect, have discovered to be the bond which connects entity with non-entity. The Secret Doctrine, 2.185. Karma desire, is essentially, the longing for active sentient existence, existence of vivid sensation, the tossing turbulence of passionate life. When spiritual intelligence comes into contact with this thirst for sensation, its first action is to intensify it. As the stanza says, from their own essence they filled, that is, intensified, the karma. Ibid. 170. Thus karma for the individual, as for cosmos, becomes the primary cause of reincarnation, and, as desire differentiates into desires, these chain down the thinker to earth, and bring him back, time after time, to rebirth. The Hindu and Buddhist scriptures are, of course, filled with this statement of truth. Until the realization of Brahman is reached, there must always be Trishna. When a man has assimilated all that he has acquired, and made it part of himself, then Trishna will arise and drive him out to seek new experiences. At first, this is a thirst for external experiences, and this is the sense in which Trishna is usually employed. There is, however, another and keener thirst, well expressed in the phrase, "My soul is athirst for God, yea, even for the living God." This is the thirst of the part to find the whole to which it belongs. If we think of the part coming forth from, but never losing the link with, the whole, then there is always a certain retractive force, trying to bring the part back. The spirit, which is divine, can find no permanent satisfaction outside divinity. It is this dissatisfaction, this desire to search, which is the root of Trishna, and which brings a man out of devachan, or, in fact, out of any condition, until the end of the search is reached. It is quite possible for a man to obtain a certain lower kind of moksha, a temporary liberation from rebirth. Thus certain of the less developed yogis in India deliberately kill out all desires belonging to this particular world. Realizing that the world is transitory, that it is hardly worthwhile to take very much trouble to remain in it, especially if there has been much suffering or disappointment, the man reaches that form of virajya, non-attachment, which is called technically burning ground virajya. This does not lead to full liberation, but it does result in a partial liberation. Page 99, as one of the Upanishads states, a man is born in the world to which his desires lead him. Hence, having killed all desire for anything in this world, the man passes away from it, and is not reborn in it. He will then pass into a loka world, which is not permanent, but in which he may remain for long ages. There are a number of such worlds, connected very often with the worship of a particular divine form, connected with special kinds of meditation, and so on, and a man may pass into one of these, and remain there for a quite indefinite time. In the case of those who have given themselves very largely to meditation, Their desire is entirely towards objects of meditation. Consequently, they stay in the mental world, whither their own desires have led them. Whilst such people have taken themselves out of the troubles of this world, they will ultimately come back to a world, either this world, if it is still going on, or a world similar to this, where they can take up their evolution at the point at which it was dropped. Hence the troubles are only postponed, and it does not, therefore, seem to be worthwhile to adopt the plan described. It is because it is possible to kill out desire that occult teachers prescribe instead transmutation of desire. That which is killed will rise again, that which is transmuted is changed forever. A person, in a very imperfect condition of evolution, who kills out desire, kills at the same time all possibility of the higher evolution, because he has nothing to transmute. Desire is dead for the present life, which means that all the higher life of the emotions and of the mind is for the time killed. The false vairagya is a repulsion from the lower, brought about by disappointment, trouble, or weariness of some kind. The true indifference to the lower things results from the desire for the higher life, and brings about a quite different result. In the voice of the silence it is said that the soul wants points that draw it upwards. By killing out desire a man gets rid of the taste for life only temporarily. The taste is there latent, and will in due time revive. If a man, who has killed out desire in the manner described, is quite an average person, with no special intellectual or moral qualities, he will remain, as said, away from this world, in a condition in which he is quite happy, but in which he is of no particular use, either to himself or anybody else. If, on the other hand, the man is one who has gone a considerable way along the path, he may have reached a stage of meditation in which his mental powers are of very great value. He may be able, even though unconsciously, to influence the world, and so help in that great stream of mental and spiritual energy which is drawn upon by the masters for their work in the world. This is the reservoir which is filled with spiritual energy by the Nirmanakars, vide the mental body, page 193. A man of this kind, who is filled with the spirit of service, would pass to a world where he could work along that particular line. It would be a world about the level of the causal body. Here he would live, literally for ages, pouring out his stream of concentrated thought, for the helping of others, and so helping to supply this reservoir of spiritual power. Page 100, Chapter 23, The Permanent Atoms and the Mechanism of Reincarnation. In this chapter we shall deal with the part played by the permanent atoms in rebirth, and also with certain further details of the mechanism of rebirth. It has already been explained, in this series of books, that after the death of the physical body, the ego steadily withdraws through plane after plane, until eventually he is clothed only in his causal vehicle. At physical death, the life web, together with prana, is withdrawn into the heart, round the physical permanent atom. The physical permanent atom then rises along the Sushumna Nadi, a canal running from the heart to the third ventricle, into the head, to the third ventricle of the brain. Then the whole of the life web, collected round the permanent atom, rises slowly to the point of junction of the parietal and occipital sutures, and leaves the physical body, now dead. As the ego vacates each of his bodies, the permanent atoms of those bodies pass into a dormant condition, and are retained in the causal body in that quiescent state. While the man is in his causal body only, he thus has within that body the physical permanent atom, the astral permanent atom, and the mental permanent molecule, or unit, as it is more usually called. These are three, wrapped in the Buddhic life web, appear as a brilliant nucleus-like particle in the causal body. They are, of course, all that now remains to the ego of the physical, astral and mental bodies of his previous incarnation. These various stages are illustrated by the left-hand portion of diagram 25. Whilst the man is in possession of all his vehicles, the permanent atoms are shown with rays projecting from them, indicating that they are actively functioning. As each body dies, and is left behind, the permanent atom concerned becomes dormant, as is shown by the plane ring without rays, and retreats within the causal body. As the permanent atoms thus go to sleep, the normal flow of life in the spirally is lessened, and, during the whole period of repose, The flow is small and slow. In the diagram, the causal body is shown, on the causal level, with the three permanent particles within it, all dormant. Page 101, the student should realize that it is necessary for evolution that these permanent atoms should be carried over. The reason being that the developed man must be master of all planes or worlds, and the permanent atoms form the only direct channel, imperfect though it be, between the spiritual triad, or ego, and the forms he is connected with.